We're continuing our 20th anniversary week of Fresh Air by playing another of Terry's interviews from 1987, the year we launched nationally as a daily show on NPR. This one is with Jackie Mason, way back before he was Jewish. Well, before he was complaining. Well, look, it's Jackie Mason, just 20 years younger. Back then, his one-man show, The World According to Me, was one of the hottest tickets on Broadway. Mason, the son of a rabbi, delivered a lot of self-deprecating Jewish humor, but also deprecated plenty of other ethnic groups. Here's a taste from his one-man show, where he's discussing the differences between Jews and Gentiles.
A Jew's whole life is absolutely different than a Gentile's. It's fascinating to notice that a Jew can't even fix a car. Did you ever notice that? He cannot fix anything. A Gentile car breaks down in 2 seconds. They're under the car, on top of the car. They clap, they hack, it becomes an airplane. There he goes. A Jewish car breaks down, you always hear the same thing. It stopped. And the wife always says, it's your fault. And he says, I know what it is, it's in the hood. Where's the hood? I don't remember there was a hood. Takes a Jew 3 hours to open a hood, then he looks under the hood. Hey, is it busy here? Then he makes a move and she hollers, watch out, you'll hurt yourself.
Jackie Mason, you come from an Orthodox family of rabbis. Were you exposed to comics or to nightclubs when you were growing up?
Not only wasn't I exposed to comics, I never even heard of comics. I didn't know there was such a thing as comedians when I was growing up. I thought when I was funny around the table in the house, I thought I was the only person who knew how to be funny in this whole world. I never saw comedians because you're always in the yeshiva, which is a Hebrew academy to study to become a rabbi. And the only thing I saw was rabbis in front of me, teaching me to keep my mouth shut, not to talk, not to say something funny, not to talk aloud, not to talk at all, not to move, not to turn, just to sit and pass away right in front of people. That's all you're taught. It's a very rigid kind of an atmosphere, and certainly nightclubs was the most distant thing from my life. It's as far as... It's like mining for uranium. You didn't see it in the neighborhood. You know uranium exists, but you don't expect to bump into it.
It's funny. You've said that you became a rabbi because you didn't want to disobey your father, and your father wanted you to become a rabbi. Did you learn anything about timing and working an audience when you were delivering sermons as a rabbi?
As a matter of fact, that's a good question. You know, it's hard to believe that you're going to get a good question on a show like this. But this is a very good question. I'm kidding. I hope you noticed that. I noticed you're not laughing when I said that. Because this is a very incisive question. Very few people think of asking a question that has that much insight. I'm proud of that question. I'm so proud of the question, I forgot the answer. Anyway, the point is that there is a very great similarity between a rabbi delivering sermons and a comedian telling jokes. Because if a rabbi is strictly serious on the pulpit, he'll lose his whole audience in an hour because people don't really go to a congregation or a religious house of worship to practice religion. They go there to practice everything but religion. It's a community center of activity. It's the only place where the Jewish people get together, and they're there for different reasons than religion. Ostensibly, the pretense, it's a religious house of worship, but everybody's there for everything but that. And when the rabbi, when he starts preaching to you about religion, he's only an intrusion. He's a disturbance to them. All of a sudden, you have to keep quiet, and you can't pass all the gossip around. However, if he's a capable rabbi, he has to try to find a way to mesh that need of the people for gossip and entertainment, and also at the same time slip some significance into his messages, because he's morally obligated to do it, to teach them and preach to them about something moral, meaningful, about the life of the hereafter, about more profound thoughts and ideas of why we're here on this earth.
Let's talk about 1964, when you did the now famous Ed Sullivan Show, and you were in the middle of your routine. He was gesturing you to get off because he had just gotten word that the president was going to make a short speech and it was going to interrupt the program. So he was gesturing you to get off, and you were gesturing him with the same kind of fingers he was giving you. He later said that you gave him the finger. You denied it. There was almost a suit and a countersuit. But anyways, what went through your mind when he was giving you the signals to get off?
Boy, you do a lot of homework. You'd
have... I watched the show, didn't you?
Oh, you watched the show at that time?
All of America was watching the Ed Sullivan Show then,
oh,
right?
Oh, boy. You know everything. you're like an encyclopedia of my career. Anyway, the point is that what happened there, as you just recounted it, is exactly right. That's exactly what did happen. You sound like you just read about it last night, because the fact is that he misunderstood my gesture, because he himself thought that when a guy moves a finger, the only thing he himself could think of was a dirty gesture. Because he came from the New York streets, and he knew about dirty gestures. I came from rabbinical institutions all my life, and I never heard of a dirty gesture when I came to his show. I had no idea what it even meant. Now, the proof of the matter is that I was right. I was telling this to people for 20 years, and they were very cynical when I would say it this way, because they would say, who is he kidding? He didn't know what it meant. He's a phony, because Ed Sullivan called me a fraud and a liar, and he said that I purposely gave him a filthy gesture. So naturally, if he's the superstar and the symbol of authority in America, and I'm a young budding comedian who doesn't mean that much, they have to assume that I'm the liar and he's telling the truth. And then they even imagined they saw what he told them they saw, a filthy gesture. But just 2 months ago, on 2020, Barbara Walters replayed that actual scene from the old tape. And when they replayed the tape, they actually went in slow motion following my gesture. And they proved on television that I never made such a gesture. Barbara Walters said to America, isn't it amazing how a person could be so misunderstood?
So after this happened on the Ed Sullivan Show, did you feel like you were being blacklisted?
I was not being blacklisted, but it really put a bad damper in my career. I can't deny that, because I was a very hot piece of property at that time. I seemed to be zooming with a brilliant new career. I was a conversation piece as the new hot comic, or one of the 2-3 hottest comics in the country. I was not yet a major star, but it looked like I was being offered every major situation that I would inevitably become a major star in a very short order. And all of a sudden, that put a definite crimp in it. All of a sudden, people saw me as some kind of a crazy maniac who can't be trusted. When Ed Sullivan said that this man did a filthy thing, people who watched the show actually thought they saw it, and they never did. But that's amazing power of suggestion.
My guest is Jackie Mason.
That's right.
You started out without any experience having seen comics. Did comics take you under their wing and bring you into the club, so to speak?
I'll tell you frankly, I'm not too close to too many comedians. I find that there's too much jealousy among comedians. This is a very, very insecure, nerve-wracking business. Everybody's on an ego trip that's usually sick to one extent or another. Most people don't become comedians because they want to entertain people. They become comedians because they feel rejected and nervous and helpless. All the studies made about comedians and their personality structure shows that they're all psycho cases. That it's very hard to find a normal comedian. A person who's so desperate for attention that he has to become a comedian, it has to be sick to start with. It has to be a chemical or emotional imbalance. You have to feel terribly rejected in your house, in your home, in your environment. There was a big brother who was 10 times smarter. There was a sister who was 10 times prettier. You were the one neglected, rejected. You were really short, fat, or ugly, or miserable, nauseous, and disturbed. And you got absolutely nothing to live for. As a desperate move, you take a chance and you become a comedian. That's how most comedians start. And all the studies made of their character, of their personalities, proves that they almost always start from a warped position of a sick personality. And then the answer to a terrible personality problem and a terrible feeling of total rejection is to either hide completely or to go in exactly the opposite direction. You either be, it's like the old story. From one family, you either become a murderer or a judge. One brother becomes a murderer, the next one a judge from the same family. And people say, why? It's because both people needed something extreme to overcome the misery of their circumstances. A comedian is in a very extreme way of looking for attention. You know how sick you have to be to go up on a stage in Iowa to people that never heard of you, and you're 19 or 22 years old, and you have to beg people to laugh at you with jokes that are not finished yet, and feel all the rejection and the contempt that people have for a person who is wasting their time not being funny. If you sing a song and it stinks, nobody notices it because they heard of the song, it's close enough, it's better than nothing. But if you hear a joke you never heard before and it stinks, you're wasting the guy's time and the guy is getting nauseous and he wants to throw a chair at you.
Is this a way of saying that you've been a psycho case yourself and that's
right.
Why you're a comedian?
That's right. I can't deny it. I certainly am. I always felt rejected in my environment at home. I had three brothers older than me. I always felt left out. The brother right above me was a phenomenal genius. He's an absolute genius. By the time he was 9, he was graduating from 4 university. He was getting medals of honor from people who had never heard of him. He was sitting around with all kinds of medals like a general. And I was the one who nobody noticed. So I started to try to be funny. It's not hard to tell what motivated me to try to look for attention in one way or another. And to overcompensate by being the belle of the ball by becoming a comedian. Because I knew I couldn't compete with him scholastically or intellectually.
You seem to me to be one of the comics who's never had any writers write for them. Is that right?
Right. I never did.
Why?
Because I don't need them. Why don't I have somebody sit down for me? Because I sit down myself. Why don't I go for somebody to dance for me? I dance myself. If this is my business, I don't feel like I need somebody else to do it for me. Not that I'm reflecting against the ones who do. There's nothing wrong with doing words that somebody else wrote. If you could do them effectively and get the same laugh, who says that you have to write it yourself? Nobody does. People play Shakespeare. They don't have to be Shakespeare. But I don't find that I need somebody else to write for me. I like what I come up with, and I am involved in my own thoughts, and it expresses my own ideas. And one of the pleasures in my mind, as much as performing it, is the thought of it. And I'd like to be the one who thought of it.
Well, Jackie Mason, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Well, thank you. It's my pleasure. You're a lovely lady. I haven't seen you yet, but I love your attitude and your intelligence of your questioning.